Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight, today. We don't have many lunchtime functions, so I should say many thanks to Clayton Yutz for their hospitality and for providing this fine facility and the refreshments. It's already been commented on there. They're one stage up from what we usually offer, I think. As Barry Humphries once said, I mean, people only go to the theatre when they're hungry, so I can see why you're all here. What we have today, as you know, the launch of Anne Henderson's Enid Lyons Leading Lady to a Nation. So I just set out how it's all going to run. Malcolm Turnbull is going to launch the book. Anne Henderson's going to make some comments. And Tony Moore is going to wind up on behalf of Pluto Press. So I'll introduce our three speakers very briefly. Malcolm Turnbull makes a very welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He was here a couple of months ago and gave an important paper on taxation and other related matters, but he's back today to launch this book. As you know, he's a lawyer, a journalist, an author. He's played a significant role in business, and since 2004, the member for Wentworth, and of course a cabinet minister in the Howard government, and currently the shadow treasurer in the National Liberal Party, National Party Coalition Opposition. Anne Henderson, of course, the author of the book, and our deputy director, Tony Moore. He was also speaking at the Sydney Institute earlier in the year. He was formerly, until February this year, the commissioning editor at Pluto Press. He's worked with the ABC. He's done some work in policy. He's writing a book on political convicts who came to Australia, and he's just finished his PhD, I think, virtually. I think he walked in the door, Mr. Moore, and worked out Dr. Moore, which shows all these things can happen at the Sydney Institute. So that's the running list. Well done, Dr. Moore. That's the running list. So we'll start off with Malcolm Turnbull. Many thanks.
Thank you, Jared, and thank you, Sydney Institute, for inviting Lucy and I here today, and, of course, to Clayton Yutz for, as ever, generously providing the hall and the refreshments. Now, Anne Henderson's biography of Enid Lyons is a revelation of a world that has passed into history and a woman whose place in history has been neglected. Dame Enid Lyons was not just the first woman to sit in the House of Representatives, or the first to hold cabinet rank. She had 11 children. She was the teenage bride of a Tasmanian treasurer, and as the wife of Prime Minister Joe Lyons, one half of a powerful and charismatic political partnership that captured the attention and the affection of the nation like no other. Reading Anne's book, I constantly regretted that Enid Lyons agreed to become a dame. Dame Enid Lyons sounds so formal, so stuffy, so conventional, and yet she was anything but that. She was the ultimate homemaker, as she said in her maiden speech in 1943, which really repays to rereading. It's a remarkable maiden speech. And she said in her maiden speech in 1943, when the subject of population was discussed, she had not pondered it, and I quote, "With my feet upon the mantelpiece," in other words, like all the blokes in the House of Representatives had pondered it, "but knee-deep," she said, "in shawls and feeding bottles." And in reminding her audiences and her colleagues of her domestic credentials, she never failed to puncture the self-assurance, some would say the pomposity, of public men who speak with such authority about family issues. Enid Lyons was the ultimate superwoman. Talk about work-life balance. From the very beginning of her marriage as a child, 17, to Joe Lyons, she combined relentless fertility in the home with constant political action and advocacy on the public platform. She's living in northern Tasmania without a telephone for many years. She travelled with Joe and separately to serve their combined political mission. And while ambitious and determined, she wasn't a cold political operative. She was wickedly funny, with a gentle mocking wit which was only occasionally cruel, as when she described the wife of Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin, and I quote, as looks like a public building and behaves like a steamroller. I should say a little about her husband, Joe Lyons, because while Enid achieved several firsts in her own right, her main contribution was as the equal partner of Joe Lyons. She married him, as I said earlier, as a teenager, 17. He was an up-and-coming Tasmanian Labor politician and minister, the Treasurer and Minister for Education. At 18, she was the wife of the Tasmanian opposition leader, and for 7 years thereafter. He was Premier then for 5 years, lost an election, moved into federal politics, where he distinguished himself, as he had in Tasmania, for sound economic management. Now, the context of the Labor government in that day, led by Scullin, was all about economic issues. It was the Great Depression, and you had those advocating expansionary policies like Ted Theodore, the former Queensland Premier, who was the Treasurer in the Scullin government and was constantly mired in one political scandal after another. And, of course, you had here in Sydney the big man himself, Jack Lang, John Thomas Lang, whose recklessness and charisma combined to create a formidable threat to the Labor government and indeed to, in some respects, to government generally. He was a remarkable man. I got to know him in his late 90s when I was a young student and journalist. When I wrote his obituary, I was struggling with a headline and I could only sum it up by saying Jack Lang, the man who knew how to hate. He was a formidable, powerful politician. But Joe Lyons took him on as he took Ted Theodore on, and he made his reputation, and perhaps this is a lesson for all politicians to remember, he made his reputation as a leader who was prepared to do things which were not always popular, but which were always prudent. He was a genuine economic conservative. His campaign for a bond issue, the All for Australia Day bond issue, put the Australian nation in a position where it was able to refinance its loan obligations to British creditors. He enabled Australians to liberate themselves from foreign creditors. He resigned from the Scullin government in January 1931 in protest at the return of his other, one of his two archenemies, Ted Theodore, to the cabinet. And he moved over to the United Australia Party, which was the main predecessor, I suppose, of the Liberal Party, and he became Prime Minister in 1932. He took on Jack Lang in that year, and that was the year that Lang was sacked, and it was, if you look at that handsome red granite building in Martin Place, which is the headquarters of the Commonwealth Bank of Australia, remember that was the Government Savings Bank of New South Wales, and that was part of the price, the financial price that the taxpayers and the citizens of New South Wales paid for the financial collapse of this state during that struggle that became part of the Commonwealth Bank. Now, in 1939, Joe Lyons died in office, and he left Enid a widow and a single mother with 11 surviving children. She was, within 4 years, an MP in her own right. She won the seat of Darwin, which is now called Braddon in Tasmania, in the 1943 election, which was the bleakest year for the conservative side of politics in Australia. The primary vote for the Conservatives, for the UAP and the Country Party, the coalition, if what we would call it today, was a mere 33%. It was a devastating election. So she was the one bright hope, and she gave enormous cheer to the, you know, the non-Labor forces in the federal parliament. She was then one of the first members of the newly formed Liberal Party, and she was, if you like, a founding mother of the Liberal Party, just in the same way that Robert Menzies was a founding father. And I have to say that one of the great traditions and features of the Liberal Party is the way in which equal representation for men and women is part of the organisational structure. So those of you who are members of the Liberal Party or familiar with it will know that we have male vice presidents and female vice presidents right through the system. And that owes it, that is owed to the leading role that Enid Lyons and many other women and women's political organisations played in its foundation. She was a bit of a rock star. She was a superstar. She was she had an enormous fan club. She was a very popular newspaper and magazine columnist, and she wrote right through her life, not out of a desire for self-promotion, but as much as anything, out of a desire not just to promote her political values and ideals, but in order to keep the household together. It was a considerable financial struggle. This was a family that had enormous obligations with so many children, but very little in the way of income beyond initially Joe's parliamentary salary, then Enid's, and then, of course, what she could generate from journalism. Now, she was also struck a great blow in the defeat, as did Joe Lyons, in the defeat of sectarianism in Australia. They were both Catholics and, of course, leading Catholics on the conservative side of politics. To a large degree, a sectarian divide in politics in Australia, and there were few Catholics on the conservative side of politics. That, of course, is well and truly a thing of the past. It's interesting, that's what I can say with some authority, but it's interesting to note that when Lucy's father, Tom Hughes, was Attorney General in the Gorton government, people remarked on this, you know, prominent Catholic moving into the cabinet. So it was a it was something of note in 1968. Of course, it isn't. It's a non-issue today, and that's very good. Now, Enid Lyons was a profoundly practical politician. She spoke in the here and now of the problems of the day and the policies they demanded. So without departing unduly from my task today, and in the spirit of Enid Lyons, let me make a few brief points about the Liberal Party of 2008 and the challenges it faces in the years ahead. These are tough times for our party, but we've had tough times before, as Enid Lyons knew well. The Liberal Party exists to promote good government based on our liberal principles, and yet we are in government nowhere. Our supporters are entitled to feel let down. Incompetent Labor governments remain in office, and unqualified Labor oppositions win office. My certain belief is that our best chance to return to federal government is in 2010. Kevin Rudd did not deserve one term, and we must not allow him to win a second by default. But to win in 2010, we have to be leaders with policies that are consistent with our political philosophy. And I tell you, my friends, our political values are the values for our time. Because at the very core of our reason for existence is a commitment to freedom, to individual enterprise, to creating an environment where every person is best able to pursue their own ambitions, their own pursuit of happiness. Labor believes that government knows best. We believe that government's role is to enable us to do our best. Our vision for government is to enable and to empower. Labor's is to direct and to command. Now, that political touchstone of freedom is easy for governments to overlook, and Liberal governments are not exempt from that temptation. So while we should be proud of our achievements in the past, we must not be captured by them. We must challenge every policy, every program, every regulation, every tax with this test. Does this make Australia more free? Does it enable greater choice? Does it impose a burden or a restriction on freedom which is more than is absolutely necessary? That is a Liberal's key performance indicator. It is freedom above all else. Now, some people will say that pursuing freedom is not consistent with social justice. That is as wrong today as it was when Lenin said cynically but most revealingly, freedom is so precious it must be rationed. A free society must be a fair society. We cannot as individuals have the freedom to pursue our ambitions if there is no safety net, if poverty or illness or disability deprives an individual of every dignity, every opportunity. Our goal must be, as liberals then, to strive for an Australia of which people can say there is no country in the world where a man or woman is more free to pursue their dreams, no country more receptive to new ideas, no country more welcoming to enterprise and initiative. And it must also be to strive for an Australia of which people can say there is no country in the world where a person who is set back by disability or illness or poverty has more support and encouragement to enjoy the opportunities of a free society. Those values of freedom, of equal opportunity, are profound and they are enduring because they are human. And it was to human values that Enid Lyons always returned. She was fundamentally a woman in touch with human values, with the real world. And I tell you that deep in our DNA is a desire for freedom, to be ourselves, to be different, to make our own mark. And if you doubt me, consider how technology has dramatically expanded choice and individual freedom, and how universally that has been embraced. Freedom is in the spirit of the times, and that is why our values are in the spirit of these times. The Labor government, the new Rudd government, is the emptiest we've ever seen. There is a yawning gap, a vacuum, between the rhetoric and the reality, between the empathy and the action. Where is the thread of principle that connects a Prime Minister who spends a year loitering around petrol station forecourts, dripping with empathy for rising prices, and then today, like Chauncey Gardner says, I like to watch? Where is the substance in a government that came to office as fiscal conservatives, dead against protectionism, and then gave $35 million to Toyota to build a car they were going to build anyway? $35 million Mr. Watanabe said he did not know how to spend, or which ignores the advice of Treasury and instead of inquiring into the motor industry via the expert and impartial Productivity Commission, puts together a committee of trade unionists and industry lobbyists headed by the former Victorian Labor Premier. Where is the evidence-based policy in a government which, seeking $3 billion of extra tax revenues, disguises it as a health measure based, so we were told, on the remarkable assumption that if one type of alcohol is made more expensive, drinkers will not move to a cheaper alternative? What can we say of the hubris of a government that underestimates the enterprising ingenuity of the Australian drinker? Our opportunity, our responsibility, is that faced with a government of spin and little substance, faced with a government that, like Chauncey Gardner, is content with simply being there, to be an opposition of substance which clearly sets out those values for which we stand, which presents policies consistent with those values, and which every hour of every day reminds itself that our duty to this nation is to enhance the freedom and the enterprise that has made it great and will make it greater still. All of us in public life stand on the shoulders of those who went before us. And Dame Enid Lyons, is in the forefront of those who have made Australia the great nation it is. This is a worthy biography. It's overdue. It's been beautifully written by a woman who has a keen insight into the character, the qualities, the determination, the courage, and the essential humanity of Enid Lyons. And I'm deeply honoured, Anne, that you've asked me to launch this book. Thank you.
So I should have mentioned earlier that Janet Grundy from Next Chapter Books has got some copies of the book, and I'm sure Anne would be happy to sign it. So, Anne.
Well, thank you, Malcolm. I'll have to move electrics now. That was great. Enid would have been very proud of you. I wonder what she might have said. It's funny to be here today addressing you because I've got the subject of my last book sitting in the audience, Blessed Joyce the Angel, and her book's just been republished, so say hello to Joyce. Before I go any further, I also want to thank Sarah Chris from Pluto Press, who worked tirelessly in the last stages, especially for this book. I was in New York at the last point where we were checking the index. Thanks, Sarah. What Dame Enid Lyons may have said to me on a day like today is anybody's guess, but she certainly would have marvelled at and enjoyed the thought that her legacy and life were being celebrated so long after her death and well over a century after her birth. As Malcolm has made quite clear, Enid Burnell Lyons lived a large and full life, and some of that is with us today in the presence of members of the extended Lyons family. With 11 children who lived to adulthood, she actually had 12 and one died at 10 months while she was the Premier's wife of Tasmania. Her extended family is a vast community, and I would especially want to thank today Mary Pridmore, who's here from Hobart. Thank you, Mary. Mary led me along many paths finding family members and family remembrances, and her brothers who are here, one from Burnie, Paul, and another from Sydney, David. Now, I was going to thank and welcome Libby Lyons, who is making sterling efforts to come here from Perth. Her plane was cancelled last night, I won't say the airline, out of Perth, and she rerouted through Brisbane to find herself in Coolangatta this morning. She was flown to Brisbane, where she landed at about 11:30, and is still heroically making her way here. All I can say is it's a story rather like Enid trying to get to Joe's bedside at the last moments. But we welcome her this afternoon when she gets here. Recording and capturing accurately a life as full as that of Dame Enid Lyons is no small undertaking. So it was with reservation that I initially responded to a phone call from Tony Moore, who was then at Pluto Press. It was over 2 years ago. Within a day, however, I'd given a firm yes to Tony's idea that it was the right time for a biography of Enid Lyons. Tony Moore had gauged it correctly. It is a time for a rethink about Enid Lyons, as well as a assessment of both Joe and Enid Lyons and their place in Australian history. And I think it's time for both the Labor Party and the Liberal Party to welcome them into the fold. We are, after all, in the 21st century. They were Australia's first power couple, and a Labor power couple as much as a non-Labor one, and well before the term was used. Today, the term power couple is increasingly familiar and relevant. Examples like Bill and Hillary Clinton, Barack and Michelle Obama, and our very own Malcolm and Lucy Turnbull. Lucy, welcome. And maybe there's more to come. But it was very different not so long ago, which is why the Lyons phenomenon is so remarkable and deserves to be at the forefront of our political records. It was not quite 80 years ago in this part of Sydney, not far away from here, a few days after Good Friday in April 1939, witnessed the funeral of Joe Lyons. He had collapsed on the way to the Easter show and died soon after on Good Friday. The mourning and grieving that followed across the nation, with a funeral at St Mary's Cathedral and a procession of his coffin to the docks for a trip aboard a destroyer to Devonport and final burial, engulfed Sydney. Thousands lined the streets to watch Joe Lyons go as the procession wound its way from Park Street, down George Street, up Martin Place, but then not a mall, along Macquarie Street to Circular Quay. The photo, which was published in the Australian's Weekend magazine a couple of weekends ago, shows something of the pomp and tragedy that surrounded this moment in Australia's history. There we see robed Catholic clerics alongside naval officers, powerful symbols of church and state, burying the humble Tasmanian Joe Lyons, who had risen to then unequalled heights and become the first Australian Prime Minister to die in office, and having equalled Billy Hughes' record of winning three successive elections for his party. But Joe Lyons had become so endeared to average Australians in his time in federal politics had much to do with the woman who became his wife at the age of 17 when he was Tasmanian Treasurer and Minister for Education when she was a trainee teacher. Would have caused quite a scandal these days. Their relationship with Joe, so much older than Enid, would draw a diversity of strengths and talents, each supporting, coaxing and coaching the other in a mutual endeavour. When 17-year-old Enid married Joe Lyons in 1915, she was just a girl, even if mature beyond her years. But with Joe as her guide, she soon took a crash course in politics and electioneering as she supported her husband's career. The difference with Enid Lyons was that her husband recognised very early on in their relationship that Enid's natural talent for public speaking could quickly become a political asset for him, especially after a few lessons on how to handle hecklers from the floor. What's more, as time went on, Enid found she loved the political stage, and in 1925, as the mother of seven, she was urged by her husband to stand for the state seat of Denison in Hobart when they needed Labor women to stand for Parliament. She campaigned vigorously and only lost by a small margin, even though all the children got mumps and chicken pox and whatnot at home. Enid Lyons would become not just a supportive spouse to her very political husband, but a partner in his public appearances. Together they addressed huge rallies in 1931 as the popular citizens' movements gathered in town halls across eastern Australia, condemning the Scullin government. By the time Joe Lyons had become Prime Minister in the landslide election of 1931, Enid was known across the nation as a public figure in her own right. When Joe Lyons died in office, he was only 59. Enid Lyons was left with eight of her children still to finish school, the youngest barely in kindergarten. Yet she went on to withstand a bitter campaign against government annuities proposed for herself and her children, although these were eventually passed into legislation. I think at one stage she received a dead rat in the post. Then, incredibly, Enid Lyons knocked back her own annuity when she began radio broadcasting, and later when she wrote newspaper columns and gained a seat as the first woman in the House of Representatives and went on to be in federal cabinet. Now, researching a life and writing up discoveries is an absorbing experience, and while I've never had the opportunity to meet Enid Lyons, even though I lived in Launceston when she was a lively local member of the Devonport community, there is a lot of Enid Lyons I now feel I know. That's the problem of doing research, all the pluses. Sitting in the National Library and Archives, turning over the pieces of a person's very private and public life is a unique and very intimate experience, and I'd recommend it to anyone who has not done it. Such fragments to construct the whole of a life. The day, though, that I turned over a telegram from 1943 and read words sent to Enid Lyons from the man I had been given good reason to believe may well have been her biological father, Aloysius Joyce, one of whose great-granddaughters is here today, was a day I'll always remember. I may as well have found gold. Telling our stories and remembering our heroes is very important. I've enjoyed and, more importantly, learned immensely from working on the life story of Dame Enid Lyons. As a person who was faithful to her strong moral code and as a person who never refused a jump, Enid Lyons is a model for us all. Thank you for coming. Thank you, Tony, for the suggestion I do it, and I hope you all enjoy Enid. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne, for those very kind words. It's my honour to move the vote of thanks. Before I do that, I just want to say, some of you may know Pluto Press is a Labor or left-wing press, and I've been asked by a lot of people why a left-wing publishing house should be interested in a Liberal politician, particularly a Liberal politician that was, in some quarters, has been called a rat as well as being sent a rat. There are at least four answers as to why we wanted to do it. Enid and Joe are part of Labor history. They gave so much to both sides of politics. She was a remarkable woman, and as Malcolm said, she was one of the pioneers of what we now call getting the work-life balance right, and her story resonates today for that reason. Her life is a ripping yarn full of surprises. In an era of Iguanagate and the AWB, it's great to have an old-fashioned bodice-ripping paternity scandal. That was a surprise when we asked Anne to do the book. No one expected that, and I know there's still heated debate about this, but as a publisher, I was very pleased.
finally, and most importantly, as a progressive publisher, Pluto has an interest in what we like to call the reforming centre. Sometimes we call it the radical centre. I think I heard Kevin Rudd call it the reforming centre. That challenges the orthodoxies of both right and left, that values small L liberalism as well as public service. Now, Joe and Enid dwelt in that space. So does our author, and I suspect so does Malcolm Turnbull, who I thank so generously for giving of his time today and putting his name, I guess, to the memory of this legendary Australian. Malcolm, may you be inspired by Enid's determination to break the political mould. I want to particularly thank Anne for her ability to write such an engaging story. I had the pleasure of reading the first draft while motoring, as they used to say, around Tasmania. And you really brought Tasmania alive for me. I had to, you know, going through Devonport, it was amazing. It was like those Let's Go Europe's, or it was terrific. I was especially moved by your almost Lawsonian account of Enid's childhood and her parents' childhood. I really recommend that part of the book. It brought to life the humble timber communities that really Australia was built on in the late 19th century, their enterprise as well as their collectivism, getting back to that reforming centre theme. You inspired me to visit Enid's house, and I must confess, having by then known the secret, I felt very guilty as the lovely National Trust lady took me around and sang in its praises. I'm happy to say I have a photo of my 10-year-old daughter wearing one of Enid's hats. So I recommend everyone go to that house. So thank you, Anne, for accepting this project and making it so much your own. Thank you.
So many thanks to Malcolm Turnbull and Tony Moore, and of course to Anne. As you know, those of you who come regularly to our functions know that we always have a question discussion period except at book launches and our annual dinner. So Kevin Rudd escaped a question discussion period at our annual dinner, but he had one last year, and Malcolm Turnbull escapes one tonight, but he had one earlier in March. So that's the way we go. I just follow up Tony Moore. Made a comment about Home Hill. It is open. It's a National Trust house in Devonport. It is open, and it's apart from the home of John Curtin and the home of Ben Chifley, it's the only other Prime Ministerial home that's open for public viewing. So if you're ever in Devonport, it's a very nice property to see. So many thanks to all of you for coming along today. We started on time. We're finishing on time, and it'll be time to get back to wherever you have to go. But thanks. Until next time, thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.